Keeping a garden healthy and thriving takes work, but there are ways to identify and treat many diseases before they can do a whole lot of damage. And by carefully selecting the types of plants in your garden and with some preventive care, you can avoid many of the disease pitfalls. Larry Mueller here. Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Pleased to have back Laura Jull, professor and extension specialist for woody ornamentals in the Department of Horticulture at UW-Madison. Laura, good to see you again. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Larry.
And with us as well, Dr. Death, Brian Huddleston, director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at UW-Madison in the Department of Plant Pathology. And Brian, always a pleasure.
Thanks for having me, Larry.
Let's turn to Laura to start with. I just saw on Facebook that a local apple orchard is starting its pruning for the season. And this apparently is a very good time to prune, is it not?
Dormant season pruning is a very good time to prune because you can see the overall architecture of the tree without the leaves being in the way. You don't have mosquitoes or flies buzzing in your face. And the insects and diseases that are normally active during spring, summer, and early fall are not active now.
Yeah, so it's a very good time. And pruning is necessary, is it not, in many cases?
It depends. You know, younger trees that are just recently transplanted, we only recommend pruning any crossing or rubbing branches or broken branches or double leaders at time of planting. Other than that, we don't recommend pruning until the tree's about 3 to 5 years in the ground.
Okay.
Then they start pruning and training pruning.
And tools? What about the tools?
Well, you want to make sure you get a sharp pruning saw, and this is not the same saw you use in your basement to build things. Pruning saw is a special type of saw. The blades are very sharp, and it's works on the backstroke, and there's many of them on the market. I can't recommend any brands, but I have a few of my own personal favorites. You also need, for smaller branches, less than an inch in diameter, you could use a pair of loppers.
Yeah.
And sharp loppers work the best. And finally, a good pair of pruners, hand pruners, and you want to make sure it's the bypass type of blade. Think of like a pair of scissors where each blade bypasses each other.
Yeah.
It doesn't lay flat on top.
Yep.
And obviously, you don't want to use scissors or a knife. You want to use a pair of pruners. It's safer, and it provides a nice clean cut. Having your tools clean as well as sharp is very important.
And, of course, to prevent spreading disease when we prune, you really need to do some basic hygiene as well.
That's correct. And particularly if you end up having to prune during the growing season, I'd be very cautious about this. But even if you're doing pruning at this time of the year, I would routinely decontaminate pruning tools. So we usually recommend either 70% alcohol, which is you can get something like rubbing alcohol.
Yeah.
Or sometimes some of the spray disinfectants contain about 70% alcohol. The other thing you can use if you're in a pinch would be 10% bleach, but that's a little bit corrosive on the tools. It'll promote some rusting, so you have to be careful with that. So alcohol is a little better option.
Yeah, excellent. Well, John in Wausau has a question, and let's go to John. Thank you very much for calling. Hi.
Hi, thank you for having my call, and Laura, Brian, and Larry. And I was wondering, I have two quick questions. I've got a yew hedge that's about 8 feet tall by about maybe 20 feet long. And I'm wondering, I've never pruned it before winter because a lot of snow sits up on top. And I think I heard somewhere that you don't prune before winter. Is that true?
Well, it really depends on the species. I still say winter is a good time to prune. But with yews, we typically wait until after the first growth flush, which happens in spring. Wait till that growth is flushed, and you can easily tell because it's a real light green color compared to the darker green needles that remain on the plant.
Okay.
And you can clip those back, but you always want to leave at least about a half an inch to an inch of the new wood. You don't want to completely cut it off because over time you'll develop this little knobby end of the branch that won't look real good aesthetically. You always want to keep some new needles that come out because eventually the older needles over many years will drop off. They're not forever.
Okay. Yeah, they look so nice in the wintertime, you know.
Yeah, I would just leave them.
Yeah, No problem.
And then
there.
The other quick question. I have on my property lines on either side, I've got a deep backyard, and they're all open right now, but I wanted to provide some privacy, and I had seen some really beautiful feathery-looking cedar trees, and I'm wondering if you might recommend some. I was thinking of staggering them so they're sort of planted in like a triangle as you look down it, so that when you look to the side, it's like a full hedge, but they're actually... Yeah, I don't know what they call that, but
staggered.
Wondering if you could recommend something that won't get too incredibly high, but will, from top to bottom, provide like a beautiful feathery screen. I don't know much about cedars.
Well, cedar's kind of a generic term. It could refer to northern white cedar or arborvitae, or it could mean eastern red cedar. Both of those have the name cedar in it. And,
don't go for red cedar.
Don't?
No.
Yeah. Well, Brian, I was just going to get to that. Our eastern red cedar, there are some nice cultivars, Brian. Come on.
Well.
But they get cedar apple rust. Yeah. But I actually like the Chinese junipers and some of the hybrids. They're more resistant to cedar apple rust. If you're going with arborvitae, there are literally over 100 different cultivars to choose from.
Yeah.
From tall trees to medium trees to shrubs to, big, globular-looking shrubs. It really depends on how tall you want it eventually to get. I do
like maybe 8 feet would probably be good for me.
Eight feet. There are some smaller cultivars of arborvitae you could use. Holmstrup, Holmstrup, and that one gets about 6 feet. Technique gets way too big. That'll get 10 feet or more in height. But there is a newer one called. Bale John, and the trademark name is Technito. That's about a third of the size of regular Techni. I mean, it does get big. It's not going to stay little. I'd say at least 10 feet. I'm sorry, 8 feet on that one.
That would be a good size.
Yeah, that's a really nice one. It's a Wisconsin selection from Johnson's Nursery, and it's released through Bailey Nursery and Johnson's Nursery, and it is available in Wisconsin. And it's a real nice one because it stays green in winter. It doesn't turn that kind of off brown color.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Yeah. Worth a look, John. Thanks a lot for calling. I appreciate your call. You can join in, too, by the way. The number to call with your question, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@WPR.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Miller Show. Taking a look at plant diseases of all types, but zeroing in a bit on woody ornamentals as well with our two guests, Brian Huddleston and Laura Jull. And again, open lines, get you on at 1-800-642-1234.
I'm the tree hugger. We got the tree hugger Dr. Death Show.
Judy in Appleton.
Good morning.
Hi.
My question is regarding the woody ornamentals. I've been gardening in this yard for 21 years, and this past fall was the first time that I had ever seen almost all of my shrubs hold on to their leaves well into the winter. Mm-hmm. In fact, some of my butterfly bushes still have withered up old leaves clinging to them. Mm-hmm. The snowball viburnums had leaves well after snow. Arctic blue willow still has a few leaves, had leaves well after snowfall. And I was just wondering whether that's a condition of the fall or... Mm-hmm. Whether it might have something to do with disease or last year's tough winter?
No, actually, you're right on target with the first response. We had a really hard November. I know because I was teaching outside with my classes, and it got cold very quickly, and I mean really cold in November. And some of these shrubs, especially non-native shrubs, they... they're not fully dormant, and they still had their leaves yet, and they hadn't formed that abscission zone where the leaf is attached or the petiole is attached to the plant, so they hung on to their leaves. They'll fall off. It's not a disease. It's nothing to be worried about. I've got my Korean spice viburnums at home still have their leaves. Some of my other native plants, even it's also with, especially with young plants, it's a juvenility characteristic. Oaks do this, so do beeches. Musselwood does this. Some plants just generally, when they're young, I meaning they're less than, you know, 15, 20 years old, they will tend to hold on to their lower inner needles through winter, and then spring comes and boom, they drop them. It's nothing to be worried about.
There we go.
I'm glad it's just a one-time thing, because especially the butterfly bushes, which are planted right outside my living room window, look really homely about now.
Yeah.
If you
can get butterfly bush to actually come back next year, you're doing good. It's a hard one to overwinter, and you got to protect them.
Thanks again, Judy, for calling. Appreciate your call. Let's turn to Nayla in Milwaukee next. Hi, thank you for calling. Are you there? Oh, wait a minute. Push the button, Larry. Hi. We'll get you on now. Sorry, that was my fault, not yours. Thank you for calling.
I just had a question whether they have come up with any possible cure or amelioration for rosette disease. I just planted some Rosa glauca seedlings last year, and I realized that the bush that I took the seeds from has developed rosette disease, and I'm wondering if that will be passed on.
I don't know of any reports that that's seed-borne, but what I would worry about would be that the insects, the mites that can move that organism around might still be somewhere on your property, and then you can get reinfection after the plants leaf out. The only really recourse you have if you have that disease is early removal of the plants. And for those of you in the audience who are not familiar with this disease, we see it on roses. And what happens is there's an infection. It's supposedly a viral disease, and it causes a lot of purpling in the foliage. The leaves will get very spindly looking, kind of distorted in growth. You get what's called brooming, which is a cluster of branches or leaves. And the flowers oftentimes are quite clustered as well, and oftentimes very distorted and odd colors. And unfortunately, it's a systemic infection, so the organism is throughout the plant, and the only way to get rid of it is to remove the plants, and I would bag those up, get them out of your yard.
Yeah, it's where we found it originally was on multiflora rose, which is a very invasive plant growing in southwestern Wisconsin. And we did a little mock study looking to see if it could transfer to other hybrid teas or shrub roses, knockouts, and so on. And it can. Spread. It's a disease. I think it's a mycoplasma-like organism.
Well, I've seen virus. I'm more inclined to think it's a phytoplasma, which is what you're... Yeah, mycoplasma-like organisms. That's what those used to be called. But it's kind of a bacterium-like organism, but the...
Well,
with
it
both
swept
of those.
Through my entire shrub rose border in St. Louis, and I am hoping that it isn't getting started here, but it was on the neighbor's bush that I took these seeds from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's spread by an insect, mites.
It's mites, in this particular situation. I'm not familiar whether or not that might be seed-borne or not. Some viruses are if it is a viral pathogen, but definitely I would watch any of those plants that come up from seed. If you start to see symptoms, simply remove them and get rid of them.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And
okay, well,
Rosa...
Baby's fine so far. So.
Okay, good.
Okay, good.
Good.
Thank you for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in as well, talking plant diseases today. We're talking about woody ornamentals with our two guests, Brian Huddleston and Laura Jell. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. Go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page, post your questions, comments, or if you got a good garden photo, that's always fun to look at as well.
Yeah.
Larry Mueller here, Jason Butler, our on-air producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you joining in on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here with my two guests. Brian Huddleston directs the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at UW-Madison. Laura Jell, professor and extension specialist for woody ornamentals in the UW Department of Horticulture, and they've come by pretty often. It's always great to have them here to talk about those woody ornamentals and plant diseases really in general. Brian certainly deals with all kinds of them. So join in. Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show, and we'd certainly love to hear from you. Let's turn to Ann in Appleton next. Ann, hi, thank you for calling.
Yes, I don't know if you can help me or not, but I have a lemon tree, a Meyer lemon tree, and I know you have limey, Larry.
Yes, I do. Limey's doing great.
I keep the tree outside when it's above 40 degrees, and when it starts to inch towards 40 degrees, I bring it in, and I have it in a south-facing window. The first year I had it, it was only 10 inches tall. I got 13 lemons off of it.
Wow.
Good job.
Yes. And last year, the squirrels stole the lemons. I think they thought they were walnuts or something. But they stripped all the lemons off my lemon tree. It's got a lot of leaf drop, and I'm very, very concerned because every day I pick up 10 leaves.
Okay.
And I'm worried that it's dying.
Okay. There's a couple things that could be going on here. Anytime we bring citrus indoors, and ficus trees do this as well, weeping fig, they kind of freak out. They go from a very high light environment to a lower light. Even though you might think that a south-facing window is a lot of light, it's nothing compared to being outdoors. And so the plant is slowly acclimating to the new light level, and they will drop some leaves. The next thing I would look at is make sure you keep it moist but not wet. If it dries out too much, it will drop leaves. If it's too wet, it'll get root rot, and it can drop leaves. And then the third thing I would look for is citrus are very prone to a number of insects that can come in from outdoors into your home. You may not see them right away, but I would look for scale. I would look for mealybugs. I would look for aphids, or not really aphids this time of year, but I would look for scale and mealybugs. And mealybugs are white, and they often occur in the axle of the leaves where it meets the stem, or on the back side of the leaves. And scale is like this little bump on the actual branch that you can actually scrape off with your fingernail, and it's not the same as lenticels. Scale is typically an insect. The adult does not move, and underneath her, the female, she lays eggs. And after a certain period of time, those eggs will hatch, and then the crawlers will come out. They're very tiny, and they will land on the branch and start sucking the sap out of the plant. So those three things right there is can you think of anything else, Brian?
The other thing I would check, how recently have you transplanted?
I just transplanted it yesterday.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Because I'd worry about it being root-bound and possibly not
being
able to take
up sufficient
water.
Oh, no, it's not root-bound.
Okay,
and I was very careful to put it in a very wide-topped container, shallow, wide-topped container, because I know those roots are close to the surface.
Yeah. Does your pot have drainage?
Yes.
Okay. That's very important.
What I typically see if I have a citrus plant come in will be, if it's a disease, is a root rot problem. But I agree, mites, other insect issues.
Yeah, spider mites is another one. I forgot about that.
No, I don't have any spider mites. I'm familiar with all of those insects that you described.
Okay.
I did have a problem with leaf drop on it when I took it out in the spring.
Yep.
Yeah.
But it fully recovered very quickly and grew lots of new leaves. Now, the leaves are getting like a yellowish, mottled appearance to them.
Okay.
And in some cases, it will even be like dark spots as well.
Dark spots. When's the last time you fertilized it?
Yeah, that was another thought I had as well.
I fertilize it every 3 months with azalea, rhododendron, and acid-loving plant fertilizer.
Uh-huh. Well, in the wintertime, we don't fertilize indoors as much because it's not really pushing a lot of growth, and you don't want to get salt buildup in the soil. Mm-hmm. When you took it out of the pot, how did the roots look?
The roots looked great.
Okay.
Okay, that's good.
And no odor or anything like that?
No, none whatsoever. I provide really good drainage in my potted plants because I know that can be an issue.
It could just be simply it's acclimating to the lower light. I know ficus weeping fig, a common houseplant people put on their deck in the summer. It looks great. They bring it inside, and it's like fall indoors.
You look at ficus, and it drops leaves, quite frankly.
Yeah.
Yeah. I use a fish emulsion, a couple tablespoons of that I throw in for limey every week. It's 7-1-1. It's a 7-1-1
You named him Limey?
Well, my daughter named her Limey.
Aw.
Limey produces limes like you wouldn't believe. Just tons.
Wow.
I was so hopeful with this when I got it because I could not believe all the lemons I got on it the first year I had it. And then last year I got four really large lemons on it, but the squirrels decided to take them while they were still green.
Oh, yeah.
You should be getting some flowering this time of the year. I mean,
yes,
actually,
I do have, on one of the bare branches that has absolutely no leaves on it, I have a little lemon growing and four flowers.
Yeah.
I'd like to see the squirrel carrying that lemon off. That would be a funny thing to see.
I was able to get them back because all they wanted to do, I think they thought they were walnuts because they were green, and they bit into them but just abandoned them once they tasted
them. Oh, well, I had a similar situation with Coco, the cat, who decided a half a dozen of the limes that were on Limey, he needed to bat around. And so I came home, and there's a half a dozen limes on the floor, which I wasn't happy about.
I have a cat, too, but I'm afraid she bites on the leaves, and I'm afraid she's going to get one of these thorns. It has huge thorns on it.
Yeah.
I'm afraid she's going to get one of these thorns in her mouth.
Yeah, you didn't have any white flies. Kind of,
no, none. Yeah. No white flies, no fungus gnats.
Because this is the time of the year you start
scale.
To...
Nope, no scale, no... Yeah. Spider mites.
Huh. I agree with Laura. I think it's most likely an acclimation issue.
Yeah, yeah, probably. Thanks, Anne, for calling. Good luck with... You should name your lemon tree. Lemony? I don't know, Limey. You know, Emily was like 9 when she named Limey. Limey's a couple years, been with us a couple of years now. So, Lemony? No. Think of a good name. Think of a good name. Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Joan and Hayward. Hi.
I really enjoy your show.
Thank you.
And I was, as soon as I heard what the show was about today, I had to call in. I love growing the old-fashioned roses because they're so fragrant. Mm-hmm. But what happens is they get a growth on them. It's a round growth that, you know, speaking of black walnuts, that's what it looks like.
Yeah,
and I'd like to know how to deal with it in an organic way.
Yeah, that sounds like an insect gall of some kind. Mm-hmm. There are certain insects that will tunnel into and lay eggs in the stems of or the canes of roses, and then the tissue swells and the insect develops in there. And it oftentimes is kind of a random occurrence. So the best thing to do if they look unsightly is just to prune them out.
Oh, that's what I'm doing.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's an easy fix for that. And it's not something that you'll necessarily see every year. It can be very, very random in terms of whether you see it in one year versus another.
So it's nothing to worry about.
No, it's one of those things you have much more important things to worry about. So that one you can deal with very easily.
Well, that's great to hear. Let me, if you don't mind, share with you one of the fun things to do with fragrant roses that haven't been sprayed is I make... rose petal ice cream, and it's absolutely fabulous.
Yes, I've heard of it. I've never tried it, but I'd love to. Also, lilacs. Lilacs you can do that with. Lavender.
Violets?
Yeah, it's fabulous. Yep. You should really try it.
Oh, yeah, and lavender would be good, too. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
for sure.
Totally. All right, well, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Joan. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And here we go with a photo of one of Laura's former students, Thomas Olson. And Sue says, I'm enjoying today's show. I'm a recent student of Dr. J's, and I've been busy pruning at a local orchard in Fitchburg.
Yay! All right! Awesome. Hey, Tom. Wonderful. Looks like you're having fun.
Yeah, it does look like he's having a pretty good time. So that's nice. And let's see, who we got next here? We have Pat in East Troy next. Pat, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry and guests. I'm so glad to have you on when you tell me that it's almost time to be pruning my crazy tree that started out to be a Paula plum, which was recommended by somebody on your program. And it grew fine for about 5 years and then started getting weird looking. And last year, it was creepy. It became a combination of the Paula plum, and out of the same root, the original root system took over, and it was half apple tree and half Paula plum. And the problem is that I love the apples. I got 21 delicious, I mean, they tasted very good, apples off of this half of this tree. What do I do to prune it so that it continues producing and I can maintain the peculiarity that I find very interesting?
Okay. First thing, these are two entirely different trees. What probably happened was a seed that a squirrel or some other animal planted next to your plum tree. Plum trees are in the genus Prunus. Apples are in the genus Malus. They're both in the rose family, but a plum tree cannot genetically produce an apple tree and vice versa. These are two entirely different plants.
Not a graft.
No. The grafting, I teach plant propagation here at University of Wisconsin-Madison, and you, in order to have a successful graft union, you have to be preferably in the same species, but mm-hmm. definitely the same genus, though there are some intergeneric grafts within of plants within a certain family, but it is extremely rare. I do not know of any around here that are being sold. It's more common in the citrus family and orchids and stuff, but not with... not with the rose family. These are two different plants. And it could have been that, you know, a plant seed fell in the pot when the plum tree was growing, or more likely an animal was eating the apple right next to the tree and left the seed.
All right. There you go.
And so you can prune those as you would normally.
Yeah, dormant season pruning.
Sure.
And don't remove more than like 20% at a time. And the thing is, if you do prune now, you are removing flower buds, and those flower buds develop into fruit. And personally, I would keep the apple and get rid of the plum, only because plums have so many disease problems.
They have cool diseases. I'm sorry.
Oh, Brian, you're sick.
The best one to watch for is something called plum pockets, which it's a fungal disease, and the fungus only infects the fruits, and it makes them enlarge and get really spongy, and you can actually grab them. They'll be hollow in the inside, and you can squeeze them like a sponge.
Oh, my goodness.
We've seen that the last couple of diseases. And if you grow peaches, there's a related disease called peach leaf curl, which is just a different species of the fungus. So that's a cool disease on plum that I've seen the last couple of years. Mm-hmm.
There we go. Thanks a lot, Pat, for calling. Appreciate it. We have Liz in Dodgeville up next. Hi, Liz. Thanks for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question. I've been wanting to get a very, and I don't know if you already answered this question because I'm tuning in late, but I'm looking for a very fragrant, maybe a native type of rose shrub, not a fussy type of rose, but something that would kind of spread and be very fragrant and easy care. And I live out in the country in southwest Wisconsin. And I'm wondering what type I should get and where I should buy it. When I Googled it, I found a place in Texas, but it doesn't seem like
no.
that would be the right variety.
So. There's plenty of nurseries in Wisconsin that grow roses, tons of them. And I'm not sure where in southwest Wisconsin you are.
Dodgeville?
Dodgeville and Spring Green, so the Driftless area. And
yeah.
I don't want, like, rose bushes. I just like the fancy kind. I just want like a sort of rangy looking thing that will grow and spread maybe along a fence row
mm-hmm.
or near the barn.
Uh-huh. Stay away from multiflora rose. That's invasive, and it's on the invasive species list. You cannot buy it or sell it or, yeah.
Yeah, we have that unfortunately on
our
property.
Yeah, it's awful. And then if you do have multiflora rose and you are in southwest Wisconsin, you probably have rosette disease.
That may take care of your problem
that
eventually.
May take care of your multiflora rose. The problem is if you put in another rose, that rose might get the rosette disease.
Okay.
Which is a problem. Yeah, one of my favorite fragrant roses is Rosa rugosa, rugosa rose. And
okay.
there are lots and lots of cultivars, depending on what flower color you want. But there's one in particular that is Blanc Double D Corbet. I am probably not pronouncing it right. And my French grandmother would in heaven would hate me for it. But that one is very common. And it's white and extremely fragrant. Then you always.
If I wanted a red color, what type would I get?
Oh, I'm red. That's a hard one. I know pink.
Or
but
pink. Pink would be fine too.
Yeah, there's some. As again, there's some cultivar. I think it's Frau Dagmar Hostrup. And again, that's German. So I don't know if I'm butchering these names. I'm sorry. But that one is, I'm pretty sure that one is pink and it's fragrant as well.
And where would I go to get these?
Any garden center. I'm always leery of some of the big box stores. They may or may not carry them. But I don't know, you know, in Dodgeville.
Could get into the Madison area, you're not terribly far from Madison, and there are lots of nurseries here that could sell you those sorts of shrubs.
And they're very common. But like I said, because you have multiflora rose already in your property, you may be, you know, getting...
It might not work.
But if you want the one of the most fragrant shrubs out there that is heavenly is Korean spice viburnum. Very, very nice fragrance. And of course, lilacs too.
Yep.
What did you call it?
Lilacs and Korean spice viburnum.
Korean spice
viburnum.
Okay.
Those are both lovely.
Yes.
The viburnum has kind of a cinnamony to me.
It's wonderful.
Yeah, it's just a lovely
smell. Yeah. Thanks for calling, Liz. Appreciate your call. We had we have some more phone calls and also an email from Mary. I live in the sandy, rocky soil of the Kettle Moraine. Want to plant a red or a white oak? Is this a good native tree for this area? There are oaks in all the surrounding woody areas, just not in mine. I don't know if I go with an oak, you're planting it for somebody else, you know, almost.
Right, very slow growers, but yeah. I think burr would be better in that environment.
Well, probably. In a sandy, rocky soil, it depends on the oak. There's some oaks that are more tolerant than others. Red oak doesn't like drought. And then there are other oaks in the oak group, like northern pin oak, that can take a sandier soil. So can black oak. I worry about oak wilt because those are really susceptible. They're lovely trees. I love them. And when it comes to the white oak group, white oak, I would definitely check your pH of your soil. If it's alkaline, white oak will not work. It's a very sensitive species to high pH. You could go with bur oak. You could go with swamp white oak, which doesn't have to be wet. It can tolerate some dry soils as well.
Those can be beautiful trees.
Yeah, they
You've
really
got a
are.
Dandy right on campus.
Right by the Hort building.
Right
yeah.
by where both of us
yep.
work.
Yep, and there's also one of my favorites, personally, that's a native Wisconsin tree that's highly underused, is called chinkapin oak. And chinkapin oak is found on limestone outcrop areas, meaning it can tolerate high pH very well, and it tolerates drought very well. I have a small one in my yard, and I absolutely love it, and it's got really interesting scalloped leaves, and that's a nice one as well.
What about susceptibility to oak wilt on that?
Yeah,
one?
The white oak group in general.
They're not as susceptible.
Yeah, they can get oak wilt. We've lost some.
Oh yeah.
I'm not going to say it's resistant, but they're less susceptible. But if it does get oak wilt, and it is treated right away when you first start seeing branches flagging or wilting, leaves wilting, and you get in there, have a professional arborist, certified International Society of Arboriculture. Certified arborists, and you can find a list of those certified arborists on the Wisconsin Arborist Association website. Just Google Wisconsin Arborist Association, and they have a list of certified arborists for hire. And I really stress that because the product that you use on oaks to prevent or to treat white oak group oaks is a product that is restricted use, and you need to have a certified arborist.
Yeah, and you want it applied properly.
Yes.
The main thing to keep in mind if you're going to go that route is you're talking about basically treating about every 2 years, and it's a very expensive treatment.
Yeah.
So you're talking about substantial cost to maintain an oak.
Depends on the size of the oak.
Yeah, that's true. But as it gets larger, grows, it's going to get more and more expensive to treat.
What would be a mature oak? What would be the cost? Any idea?
Jeez, I don't know.
Any?
I'd have to ask my arborist friends.
I've seen hundreds to over $1,000 to treat really, really large trees. So I think the expense can be sometimes prohibitive for some folks.
And you know, $100 to save a
$100.
I would. I mean, that the environmental benefits you get from a large tree is huge. I mean, that the lower cost of cooling in the summer, the wildlife habitat, the so many ecosystem services come from trees. So I'm the tree hugger. I know Brian likes the disease.
I love oaks as well. But again, oftentimes when I talk to people on the phone about doing these injection treatments, it really does come down to an issue of cost and whether or not they can budget for that.
Yeah.
Because it isn't a one-time treatment.
No.
We're talking
again
about every two years.
I'm thinking back about four or five houses back that I was in or owned. And that one I happened to be renting, but there was an elm tree. This has been many years back, a huge elm tree.
Aww.
And that elm tree had to come down. And when that elm tree came down, the inside temperature of the house
skyrocketed. Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It was like, oh, my goodness. I didn't realize how good we had it. And I love the tree. It was a beautiful old tree. But
Dutch elm disease?
Yeah.
And that's a disease that's very similar in terms of the way it functions to oak wilt.
Yeah. Susie in Pewaukee, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yes. I have a question about a tree peony. It's just getting a little bit too big, and I need to take it down a little bit, but are there buds on there right now that I shouldn't be trimming?
You bet there is. Especially tree peonies, there's only a couple branches there to begin with. It's not finely branched like a viburnum. Tree peonies, their flower buds are there right now, and they will bloom in spring. So if you prune them back, you're not going to have any flowers this year. I would wait until they're done flowering. Right after they're done flowering, then you can prune back to a node, you know, or where a side branch comes out or where there's a bud. Do not cut them back hard. You know, they're pretty slow growing as it is. But, yeah, I know how gangly sometimes they can look. Some people actually plant like a clematis vine near it and allow the clematis to kind of climb over it in the summertime to kind of hide some of the bare branches. I wouldn't use anything very vigorous in terms of clematis, something that is smaller growing. And there's some new clematis out there that are really nice that are smaller growing that you can even grow in pots.
There you go. Thanks, Susie.
Oh, thank you. Could I just ask a second question real quick?
Okay.
I have a tree in my yard that looks like something's been scratching on the bark, and it's at the just maybe about 2 feet up from the base of the tree. Is something scratching at the bark?
Could be. What is the tree? Do you know what it is?
I think it's a maple.
Yeah, it could be. And is the bark coming off? Like
claws? Looks like it's freshly off even, you know.
Do you live in a wooded area?
Yes.
Yeah, it might be buck rub, but that's usually
that
a different time of year.
Yeah, that's pretty low.
That's pretty low. Probably not the deer. It could be rabbits feeding. It could be a vole that's feeding, or it could be, I've seen raccoons and squirrels do that as well.
Yeah.
It's some
squirrels. I've seen squirrels do
that.
Yeah,
they
can
do
lots
of
those.
They can do a job. And really, to protect the tree, one of the best things to do is in like late fall, beginning of December, is put hardware cloth around the trunk of the tree, not tight, but and then sink it couple about an inch into the ground so it doesn't blow away. Not too deep because you don't want to harm the structural roots at the base of the tree, but that will help keep the critters from scratching the bark at the base.
And thank you for calling, Susie. Appreciate your call. Taking a look at plant diseases and woody ornamentals today with our two guests, Brian Huddleston and Laura Jell. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you listening in on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio as we talk plant diseases and also take a look at woody ornamentals with our guest today, Brian Huddleston of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at UW-Madison. Laura Jell, professor and extension specialist for woody ornamentals in the Department of Horticulture. Great to have them along, and certainly you're welcome to join in with your questions and comments. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. I did want to mention that the gang from the Orchid Society, let me know that Orchid Quest is coming up January 31st and February 1st. It's a new venue, so we wanted to bring that up. It's at the Marriott West Conference Center in Middleton, Wisconsin. That's just off Highway 12 and 14, Beltline, at Greenway Boulevard. Free parking there. There will be the usual huge orchid displays in the exhibit area. Thousands of fragrant orchids for sale. I have never gone there, but what I didn't come away with, at least, I think I did get away with only one time. Oh, man. So, they have many seminars, and there's artwork and a raffle, silent auction. Saturday, January 31st, 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Sunday, February 1st, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. $9 for admission, a two-day pass, $14. And the best thing, if you want to get some more information, go to orchidguild.org, orchidguild.org, and you're going to find out all you need to know about Orchid Quest. Again, it's at the Marriott West Conference Center. It's a nice conference center. I've been there many times in Middleton, Wisconsin.
And free parking.
And right. Free parking, yes, as opposed to Dane County. What is it called?
Alliant Energy Center.
Alliant Energy Center.
Where the Garden Expo will be occurring in a few weeks.
And you and I will be doing something together.
Yeah, we have a panel discussion with Lisa Johnson for one of the sessions.
Yep, 9:30 on Saturday, the 15th?
14th.
14th of February?
I think it's 13th, 14th, and 15th this year.
Valentine's Day.
Yep. Yes, indeed. And Friday the 13th is the first day of the program.
All right, well, let's go to Gene in Rice Lake next. Hi, Gene. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I asked this question several months ago, and nobody could answer it for me, and I thought maybe I would try again. I was rooting a ficus on my kitchen counter last winter. We left for a week. The warmer climate came back, and it was 26 degrees in our house. Pipes did not break. But the vase full of water with my ficus in it on my kitchen counter, frozen solid, but the ficus survived. I was able to root it and plant it.
Really?
Yeah, I remember this.
Yeah. I'm just hoping somebody checked into it and found out, maybe. I also had a Christmas cactus and a China doll rooting in there, and they both survived.
Amazing.
Didn't drop a ficus, didn't lose a leaf.
Wow.
Oh, you're amazing.
You're very lucky. I would have said it would have died because ficus are not winter. I mean, they can tolerate. They're subtropical plants. They're not true tropical. They do need a little bit of cold, but above freezing.
I will tell you that the ficus that I had in a pot did not survive.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
No idea. Divine intervention.
Larry, yeah. But I'm going to keep calling.
Well, it could be the water was insulating. I'm surprised it survived, quite frankly. I would have thought it would have been cooked. If it was a slow decrease in temperatures in your house that caused the freezing, that, the plant might have been able to tolerate it better than a very fast freeze, which ice crystals would form inside the cells and it would kill it.
Okay. And I think that's what happened. I think it was a slow freeze. I don't think our furnace ever came on once we left the house.
Wow.
Oh, man.
That's too bad.
Well, no pipes broke, though.
That's good.
Yeah. Yeah, that's for sure. Well, it probably means, Gene, that the next time you go away in the middle of winter, you're going to have somebody probably drop in and check the house.
Absolutely.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Oh, man. Steve in Madison, your turn. Hi, Steve.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, we've got a property line row of tall, thin arborvitae. Over 25 years, they've grown up to a kind of a ragged 12 to 16 feet tall. And I'm wondering if I can cut them back, including the main trunk, if I can cut them back to a uniform 10 feet tall And what are the cautions on doing that? And what's the best time of year to do that?
Okay. How tall are these? You said 25 feet?
No, over 25 years. They're 25 years old. They've grown up to 12 to 16 feet tall.
Okay.
And
if you
I'd like to cut them back to uniform 10 feet.
Yeah, that's an awful lot of plant material you're removing at one period. And I usually don't recommend more than 20% at one to prune time. Arborvitae is one of the few evergreens that you can cut back hard, and it has epicormic buds underneath, or latent buds underneath the bark that will break and will eventually fill it in. But boy, it takes a while. It's not something a year or two, it's going to look great. Doing selective thinning of branches to open it up a little more to get light level in there. I've seen trees that were just decimated from deer eating the foliage on the lower third of a tree. And within a couple years, it had come back. But if you're taking the top back, I don't like topping trees. That's not appropriate pruning. If it's getting too spindly, you know, there's always a replacement factor. Get a different cultivar that is shorter growing, that it is much fuller and healthier looking. When to prune, typically with arborvitaes, I recommend, you know, mainly if it's already growing in your yard, wait until the first growth flush, and then you can do light pruning or shearing. It's, again, one of the few evergreens you can actually shear. But you really shouldn't be removing the main leader and cutting it way back. It will look very unsightly, and it will take many years for it to fill in.
Okay.
There you go.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And Chris in Oneida, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. Hey, I want to ask about birch trees. I have a really large birch tree in our yard, and we're full of maples also. Mm-hmm. When would be the best time to cut them, and how should I cut them?
Okay.
Prune them, I guess.
How big are these trees?
Oh, I bet you 40, 50 feet.
Okay.
Maybe larger than that.
I would call a certified arborist to come and prune your trees. Having you prune it, I'm very leery, not saying you don't know what you're doing, but it's you would need to climb, and I don't recommend homeowners doing that. You need someone who is specialty trained in climbing trees with safety equipment and practices good pruning practices. Maples and birch can be pruned. In fact, I recommend dormant season pruning. Maples and birch do at this time of year, especially into February and March, they tend to ooze a lot of sap when you prune them. Mm-hmm. And some people think it's bleeding. It's not blood. It's okay. Just natural pressure being relieved when you cut the branch and the water or the sap is starting to flow in these trees, and it just oozes down the trunk of the tree. It's strictly cosmetic. It will not harm a tree. Don't use tree paint or wound compound or anything like that. But if your trees are that big, please call an ISA certified arborist, which is available again on the Wisconsin Arborist Association website. And they have a link and you can click on it. It says certified arborist for hire, and you can search by your county and you can find quality people in your area. I'm not pimping anybody's business here. I can't do that.
Okay.
But there are a lot of companies out there that say they're arborists and they're anything but that. They're not certified and they don't know what they're doing and they top trees, and that's wrong.
Well, we've got a lot of dead branches on the lower half of the birch tree, and I'm wondering if that could be from disease or if that's what happened.
Is it a white birch?
Is it a white birch?
Mm,
well,
yeah. Bronze birch borer.
Worry about bronze birch borer.
Yeah.
That's an insect pest. What's the environment where it's growing? Is it kind of out in the open or is it shaded?
It's kind of out in the open, and it sits between two pine trees and our house, so it gets a lot of sun.
Okay. They need sun, but they like the roots and shade.
Okay.
It's hard to make a judgment call whether it's got borers or not, and that's...
And actually, if you had a certified arborist out there,
yeah, I was just going to say they would be able to tell with your birch.
Yeah. The other thing I would watch for, if you do prune that birch, sometimes Laura mentioned the sap coming out, and sometimes that gets colonized by what we call environmental fungi. They're just fungi out in the environment that will colonize anything that's nutritious. And oftentimes on birches, the fungi that get into that sap are very highly colored. They're yeasts or other types of very highly colored fungi. And you will get this bubble gum pink material on the surface of the trunk, or sometimes it's bright orange like a pumpkin, and people really freak out about that. But that's just a cosmetic problem. That's not a disease. It once the sap stops flowing and that material dries up, those organisms will kind of disappear. You're oftentimes left with a stain on the trunk, but the brightly colored material will disappear. And I oftentimes will get photos or call us about that in the spring, and people are totally freaking out about this, and it's just a cosmetic thing.
There you go.
And it's it's super bright, and it's very obvious. Yeah, I have some pictures.
Sell it at the art fair in the square.
I was just thinking about the last birch tree I had. I had Bruce Allison come over to take a look, and he looked through my yard, and he says, "You have practically everything known to the world here. You had bronze birch borer, birch leaf miner. I had every disease and insect you can imagine on my whole variety of trees." And so we went to work on it, and I think he did help me out a lot. We are our guest today, Brian Huddleston. We were talking plant diseases and woody ornamentals with Brian Huddleston, director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at UW-Madison, and Laura Jull, professor and extension specialist for woody ornamentals in the Department of Horticulture at the University of Wisconsin. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, and tell you what, we're taking a look at plant diseases today. Some are going to survive no matter what the conditions, and others don't always do so well. There may be disease issues that come up or insect issues. So that's one thing we're dealing with. We're also dealing with woody ornamentals of all types of woody ornamentals with our guests, Laura Jull, professor and extension specialist for woody ornamentals in the horticulture department at UW-Madison. Laura, great to have you back, as always.
Great to be here.
And Brian Huddleston, director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic. And thank you for joining us today as well,
Brian.
Thanks for having me. Yeah, it's a lot of fun. Somebody asked me about the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic, and I started to explain, well, what are the functions of it? And I thought, well, wait a minute. That'd be a good question to ask Brian, who could give a more complete answer, I'm pretty sure, than me. So
basically what I do is if you have a sick plant, you think it has a disease, you can send it into my clinic. You can do this either directly or through your county extension office. And we take a look at it, try to figure out what the problem is, and then for a small fee, we will send you a report with recommendations on how to take care of the problem. And we work very closely with PJ Leash, who's our new insect diagnostician.
Yeah.
So if it happens to be an insect problem, we just kind of farm the sample up to him on second floor. I'm on first floor in Russell Labs. He's on second floor, and we trade samples all the time. So, and if you're interested in, we have a website that you're welcome to take a look at. It talks about how to submit a sample, where there's a lot of other information on there as well. We have a one-page fact sheet series called the University of Wisconsin Garden Facts. And if you want to visit that website, that entire collection is there. And Laura will soon have a new one out on Winterburn. We're working in the last stages of that, so that one will
Very
come out
cool.
soon. And my web address is pddc.wisc.edu. And if you kind of want to follow clinic news, I do have a Twitter account, and my account is at UWPDDC. I send out announcements when we have new fact sheets or revised fact sheets. I also do a weekly summary of all the diseases I've seen in the clinic, and whenever I post that on my website, I send out a tweet about that's available for people to take a look at.
Very, very cool. And obviously, PDDC.
That's
plant
right.
Disease Diagnostics.
Plant Disease Diagnostics Clinic.
I had to stop and think about that. I almost said PP, but it's PDD.
PDDC, yes.
All right. There we go. Taylor in Madison. And by the way, we do have, I think we have, I'm sure we have a link to the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic up on our Facebook page, too. So, Taylor in Madison, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, I have an answer for the woman with the pycus that survived freezing.
Yeah.
Well, it's to do with the properties of water. As
yes.
water cools, it forms hydrogen bonds, and it actually produces heat as it makes each bond. And so that will generate a very small amount of heat, which helps delay freezing. She's very lucky to have it survive. But still, it generated just enough heat as it slowly cooled to moderate the freezing. And that's why citrus orchards spray their trees.
Oh, sure.
About to have a severe frost.
Yeah.
It's the fact that water forms bonds and gives up heat.
Yep.
As it changes from
liquid to solid. It's called heat effusion. As water freezes on a plant, it releases very minor amounts of heat during the freezing process. And with some plants, that, you know, very small temperature change can help protect it from the cells, inside the cells, from having intracellular freezing. But you can't shut, like in citrus and as well as strawberry growers, apple growers, you can't shut the overhead irrigation off the whole night that it's freezing. Because once you shut it off, hard ice will form and the plant will freeze. You have to keep applying it, and then you turn it off the next morning as the temperatures are above freezing. Then you can turn it off. But I didn't get into all that detail because I figured that was more than what most people wanted to hear.
Yeah.
But her
plant in a pot probably did freeze because it was drier and had more airspace for the cold.
Exactly.
To get in.
Yeah. Good points, Taylor. Thank you. Appreciate your call very much. And we have more callers online. By the way, we had, and this is, I'm not sure, you guys probably can help on this. Well, I bet you can. Deb wondered from New London. She's looking for a seed catalog or source to purchase an interesting range of, but she's looking for vegetable seeds. But you guys plant vegetables.
Yeah, I grow vegetables.
But a broad range. She wants some kind of interesting, different, possibly.
There's tons of them out there. I know Young's Garden
heirlooms.
Centers. I don't know if they do have a couple, some heirlooms in there. Park Seed, you know, Young's.
And the heirloom varieties.
Johnny Seeds does a lot with heirlooms.
Even Seed Savers Exchange in Decorah, Iowa. And you can go online and get, I mean, a lot of these now are just online. They don't even mail anymore.
Right.
But Seed Savers for heirlooms, you have a lot of them there, for sure. Bill in Lancaster, it's up to you now. Hi, Bill.
Hi. Regarding that multiflora rose disease, about 8 years ago, the multiflora rose pretty much to a bush died on my farm here in Lancaster.
Mm-hmm.
And they have since recovered, and they're just as beautiful as ever, or horribly beautiful as ever. So I don't know. I had thought that was some sort of a rose mosaic or something, but
it was most likely this rose rosette that we discussed earlier in the program, and that probably killed off your shrubs, because it's quite lethal, particularly on multiflora rose. There's been very good documentation that you can get, 95% mortality within a couple of years of infection. So it may be that eventually that will move back in, and it may have gotten reestablished, but you may have the disease move back in and take the plants out again.
Okay, well, it hasn't come up with some sort of resistance to my mower yet.
Thanks, Bill.
It's really invasive plant.
Yeah, it really, really is. Jack in Madison, hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I do container gardening, and during the summer I put them outside, and they get worms and bugs and stuff in there, and I bring them in during the winter.
Mm-hmm.
But my big problem is, how do I get rid of those tiny little gnat flies and not kill everything in there?
Yeah, I have that problem too, and I find you get more of those fungus gnats, which they zoom up your nose and in your face, and they're really annoying. Letting your plants dry out, not bone dry where they're wilting, but if you keep plants too wet, you'll have more fungus gnats. And that's especially a problem when it's colder inside and, you know, we think we need to water more. And depending on the plant, granted, you don't want a fern to dry out. They'll be dead. But it's something to be cautious about. I don't know of anything you can put in the soil. There's pesticides, but if you have children or pets, especially pets, I came home the other day and one of my house plants was on the floor. and yeah. there was dirt everywhere. And I'm like, what was this about? And I have dogs, and usually dogs leave your plants alone. But I personally don't like to use anything. There are systemics out there that will kill fungus gnats, but if you have pets, I'd be very cautious in using anything like that.
We do have a fact sheet on fungus gnats, and I don't remember the details on control, but you might want to check that out. Again, I gave out my website if you're connected to the internet. Certainly, you can look up that particular fact sheet. If you get to my website, there's a fact sheet tab. Just click on that, and that'll take you to an alphabetical listing of all of our fact sheets, and just look under fungus gnats. And there's information about the biology and also control recommendations as well.
There you go. Thank you, Jack, for calling. I appreciate your call very much. You can join in, too. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. We have open lines to get you on pretty quickly. Susan in Milwaukee says, I have a 100-year-old white oak. The crown of some dead wood looked chlorotic. An arborist will prune it, but he recommended an FAC treatment, an injection of iron ammonium chloride. The treatment costs $400. Would you recommend it?
Okay. I'm not familiar with FAC, but I am familiar with ferric ammonium citrate. No.
That's what she's talking about. Yeah.
Yeah, not chloride. And that actually, what you have, your tree's getting chlorotic. It's probably due to higher pH in the soil. And yes, you can add sulfur to the soil, but it's a very slow process to lower your pH, and the microbes in the soil have to work on the elemental sulfur first. One thing I do recommend is getting rid of the grass that grows underneath your tree if possible, because grass is very competitive with tree roots for water and nutrient uptake. Put down bark mulch. Keep it away from the trunk of the tree. Obviously, you don't want it piled against the trunk. And no more than 3 to 4 inches. And how far you go out, as far as you can. I'm a big proponent of using mulch around on the ground near trees versus grass, because mowing grass up, you know, underneath the tree, sometimes it can be difficult, especially if it's a maple and it has surface roots. The ferric ammonium citrate, this is a product that isn't actually, it's a micro injection that goes into the tree. It is a product that is very effective in help alleviate chlorosis, but it's something that's going to have to be repeated, you know, every couple years or so. It depends on how the symptoms, and you inject it, and it's very effective. I know a lot of arborists that do it.
My concern would be that you're wounding the tree.
It's a very small injection. It's not like a big honking bullet that goes on the tree. It's a drill bit, and it's, I don't know if it's an eighth or a quarter inch drill bit. It's very small drill bit, and they put these little, kind of looks, they're rounded, and it's got a... you tap it, and then it goes into the tree. I'm not describing it very well, but it's a micro injection, and it's pretty safe, because if you don't treat it, chlorosis over time will kill the tree.
Yeah, my concern with any time you're wounding the tree, whether it's small or large, is that that can be attractive to potentially to sap beetles that could bring in the oak wilt fungus. That's my major concern with any time you're injecting anything into the tree. And in this particular case, you do injection treatments for oak wilt treatment, but you're injecting a fungicide that's going to combat the fungus. In this particular case, you're not injecting anything to prevent the fungus from getting established if it gets in.
It's usually done in the fall.
Okay.
And
then I would have less issues of that.
Yeah,
it's not active at that time of the year.
And it's probably one of those times where you might use a tree wound dressing or not.
You know, I can see using it if you're doing pruning of large, you know, branches. Again, the time of year that it's done, typically the picnic beetles aren't active if it's done in the fall.
Mm-hmm. But it was done in the summer, though, I'd say.
Yeah, definitely during the growing season, I would be very, very leery of doing that.
Yeah.
And we can get a round of actually sporulation in the fall, too, if we get the right environmental conditions of the oak wilt mm-hmm. fungus. So we tend to see more infections earlier in the season, but it's not outside the realm of possibility to get oak wilt infections later in the season as well.
As we're on diseases, here's an email from Heidi in Madison. Several perennials in my garden were diagnosed with cucumber mosaic virus. What can I plant this year to replace them? What is not susceptible to this? I had to take out labellia and Shasta daisies and some others.
Yeah, that particular virus, cucumber mosaic, it's an aphid-transmitted virus. So really the way to try to prevent having problems with that is, one, get rid of any plants that are showing any sort of symptoms. And what you tend to see is this kind of blotchy color on the leaves. You may see stunting. Sometimes you might see some flower discoloration, some striping in the flowers that can be associated with that virus. Once you see the symptoms, the plants are infected and you need to remove them and get rid of them because they can serve as a source of the virus that can move to other plants. It is aphid transmitted, so keeping aphids under control is the really big thing. There's not a lot that you can plant that isn't susceptible because that's a fairly wide range, wide host range virus as compared to some others. But the other one you have to be careful about is tobacco mosaic, which is very, very wide host range as well. We had some issues with that last year. We had some petunias that were produced by a supplier that were infected and they didn't realize it and shipped them. And that one is touch transmitted, so you can pick it up on your fingers handling plants, and then if you handle other plants, you can infect them mm-hmm. that way.
Is there any plant families that are resistant to cucumber mosaic?
I'd have to go back and double-check to see if there are any. I'm sure there are, but usually herbaceous plants in general, I'm speaking very broadly, tend to be susceptible. But to get a list of things that are technically resistant or immune, I'd have to dig in the literature to see that because, again, when I think of that virus, it's just a really broad-range virus.
Wow.
We see it on vegetables, ornamentals, and I did actually have – I can't remember the plant that came into the clinic last summer, but we did have an ornamental that came in that tested positive. Yeah. And that's the first time we've had ornamentals that have tested positive.
Darlene in Lake Tomahawk has a question. Hi, Darlene. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. I have a question concerning my flowering crab tree. It's almost 20 years old, blooms beautifully in spring, but it has thousands of holes all over the trunk. And I don't see bugs, but it's just covered with holes.
Are they in rows? Nice, neat rows?
Yes, they are.
Yeah.
It's probably sapsucker. Yeah, it's a bird.
It's a type of bird.
A bird, yes,
and they come in and feed.
Wow, yeah. What do I do?
Nothing.
Will it kill the tree?
You know, I've seen trees that had hundreds of these holes on it, and the tree was doing just fine. I mean, it's going to have to close the wound, which takes time, but there's nothing you can do to add to it to, make it heal. It's not heal, it's close its wounds fast. It's just something, they like crab apples and apple trees a lot.
Yeah, and trying to keep them away, scare them away might be something. Yeah. There is a publication that we have through our Learning Store site, and that's learningstore.uwex.edu that's on woodpeckers, and the sapsucker falls into that particular group. And I think there are some recommendations there on what you can do to try to keep them away from the trees.
Yeah, get a cat.
Yeah. Speaking of cats, by the way, we got a comment from Jeff who said, and this goes back to the scratches on the tree from a foot high. He had the same issue on one of his trees, and it turned out it was the barn cat.
Yeah.
That was scratching. And, cats love to scratch.
Oh, yeah.
And so if you got an outdoor cat, or the neighbor has, that could be the reason why you're getting all those scratch marks. But here we've got holes in that. You're almost 99.9% sure that'd be a sapsucker.
Yeah. With the nice, neat lines.
Would it kill the tree?
Unlikely. No. I don't think. What I would worry about with those, again, because the bird is wounding the trunk, there is the potential for certain types of fungal pathogens to enter through those wounds. And that would be what would potentially harm the tree and eventually kill it. But I don't think that activity from the bird itself is likely going to be the primary cause of the demise of the tree if it dies.
There we go.
Well, thank you for your help.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. It's 20 years old. That tree's been there for a while.
Yeah, but if it's still blooming really profusely, yeah. I'd say just kind of leave it and let it go.
Yeah, let it go for sure. Going back to the caller who or the person who wondered about a variety of vegetable seeds, including heirlooms, a couple of callers have already called in to recommend Baker Creek heirloom seeds. So you go to rareseeds.com, rareseeds.com. They have a catalog. So a couple of people called to make that suggestion. So that's sure worth passing along because others may be interested in that as well.
Just don't pick invasive plants.
Yes. we'd agree with that. Stephanie in New Berlin, I mean, we're talking vegetables. Hopefully you're not going to get any invasive vegetables.
Yeah.
Although
attack of the killer tomatoes,
there are some horseradish would be an example of that's not really a vegetable, but it's something that you might plant in a garden that you'll soon have a lot of.
Yeah, Jerusalem artichoke is another one that tends to spread quite a bit.
Well, Stephanie in New Berlin has a question. Hi, Steph.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question about river birch. I have a river birch in my front yard. And this summer, the leaves were turning yellow, even though I was watering it adequately. And then also, I got this on the higher branches, this fuchsia-colored sparkling layer on the top of the leaf.
Yeah, well,
that's actually caused by, a little mite that feeds on the leaves and induces gall formation. And it's actually quite pretty. They're kind of pinkish and fuchsia, like you mentioned, and very sparkly kind of looking. And we see these on a variety of different types of trees and shrubs, but I see it a lot on birch. And it tends to be a very cosmetic problem. I wouldn't be overly worried about it. And it's another one of these things that you may see one year but not see another. So that's not anything to worry about. I'm a little bit more worried about the yellowing of the leaves, which could indicate
could be chlorosis or drought. I know river birch is very sensitive to drought. They will drop their leaves. And are the leaves yellow but the veins green?
Yes, that's exactly what it looked like.
That's chlorosis. And the pH is really too high in your soil for river birch to grow. I always say, people want to plant river birch, and I recommend getting a soil test done first, because if the pH is above, 7.2, forget river birch, because it needs an acid soil. Mm-hmm. I have a river birch in my yard, and I've not done anything to it. I don't know. I must have really good soil. Actually, I do have good soil, but the pH is around 7.3, 7.4, and it's done okay. Yeah. But in most situations, when you see a very chlorotic river birch, if that's not taken care of, over time, branches will start to die back, and your tree will eventually die. You can add elemental sulfur to the soil at the appropriate rates.
I would get a soil test.
I would get a soil test first.
And have the pH checked.
If it is too high, which is above 7.2 or so, then I would do the elemental sulfur. Again, get rid of the turf grass growing underneath the birch tree. It gets very competitive with tree roots for water nutrient uptake. Put down mulch, but don't pile it on the trunk. Keep it away from the trunk, no more than 3 to 4 inches. And another thing, if it's we got to go. You can get a certified arborist to come in and look at it too.
Ah, there we go. that's the other thing. Yeah, the time flew by. Thank you guys so much. It's always a pleasure. We'll have you back soon.
Thanks for having us, Larry.
Thank you.
Brian Huddleston and Laura Jell from the University of Wisconsin, our guests. Great to have them with us, and they'll be back. But Sam Shakashuri joins us on Monday to talk about science, and our weather guys join us as well. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.